नमो यतिराजाय विवेकानन्दसूरये सच्चित्सुखस्वरूपाय स्वामिने तापहारिणे. Our salutations to that brilliant light, Vivekananda, Prince of Renouncers, who has given us a message for the world of this time, for this time, and who has removed all the miseries that beset us. Salutations to him again and again. Om Sahana Vavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Viryam Karavavahai Tejasvinavadhitmastu Ma Vindasavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being, may the Divine Being support and nourish us as Mother and Father. May we have the strength and skill. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om peace, peace, peace be unto us all. Swami Vivekananda's message to the West and his message to the East is the topic this morning. Many people who read the works of Swami Vivekananda, the booklets and the big volumes, are really unaware of the difference in his message to the West and to the East. Swamiji didn't talk out of two sides of his mouth, but when he knew that he was speaking to the West, he was very conscious of it and he tailored his message accordingly. And when he went back to India and had to talk to the fellow countrymen, he gave them a different message because they needed a different message. He felt very clearly that what the West needed was one thing and what the East needed was something else. He didn't have a chance to edit his own works. I sometimes think that it was very much too bad because if he had had a chance to do that, he would have apportioned the right lectures to the right places. But if you go through the works of Swamiji or to read his little books, you have no idea, really, whether he is talking to the world and to the Western world as he traveled through it, or whether he is building up the Indian work in his own native fashion, because it's all been translated from Bengali into English, and even though it says translated, that doesn't make the clear distinction between them. So I want to talk first this morning about Swami Vivekananda's message to the West. He appeared on the platform of the Parliament of Religions in Chicago at the World's Fair in 1893. That was his first appearance. And in public, that is. There were small parlor talks before that, but his first general address to American, to the West, was in Chicago at the Parliament of Religions. And you know what he said. He said, assuming, and rightly, that the majority of his audience were Christians, because you realize that in 1893 there were far fewer minorities in this country. I don't mean the African Americans, but there were far fewer Jews, there were far fewer Hindus, there were fewer Muslims. The religious color of the parliament was Christian, basically Christian. And some minor Swedenborgians and oddballs like us here. But basically it was Christian. And so what he said first of all to them was, go back to Christ. Go back to Christ. Why are you worshiping the almighty dollar? Our crass materialism was very much on his mind. He looked out upon this wonderful World's Fair, and of course that wasn't the very best place to see American spirituality. Some people say he should have gone to an Iowa farm, and there he might have better understood what a Native American spirituality is, but he didn't do that. He spoke of what he saw, and he had seen America from Chicago to Boston and back, and from Western Canada to Chicago. He had seen a brief picture of American life. To him, we were worshiping the almighty dollar. America was deeply involved in the pursuit of lust and gold, to be honest about it. And so he said, go back to Christ. What did Christ have? He had no place to lay his head. He was a wandering sannyasin. He had a band of sannyasis. Jesus cared nothing for money. Give to Caesar that which is Caesar's, and give to God that which is God's. And he kept quoting these things. You know, he had been brought up in, he had been educated in a missionary school in India. He knew the Christian message. He knew the Bible very well, especially the New Testament. And he could quote all those things that the Brahmo Samaj was familiar with and was accustomed to quoting. So he could turn right around to the Western audience and say to them, go back to your original revelation. What is the revelation? You depend upon your Bible. And he heard dozens, maybe 100 prelates, clergymen, ministers of different sects and forms of Christianity coming to the platform and talking their own version of the Christian message. And he came on later in the day, and he heard all those things. And so he said, do you really mean that you stand on the Bible? Because if you do, you're not really reading it. And another part of that message to the West was this. Tolerance is not enough. He smelled the aroma of the Parliament. It was all tolerance. We had gathered together, headed by a Presbyterian minister, they had gathered together to invite people from all parts of the world so that they would be able to have a greater sense of tolerance, and they would preach tolerance and show how tolerant the Christian religion was. But that wasn't good enough for Swamiji. He said, tolerance means, I hate what you say. I don't care for your message, but I'll permit you to live. Ours is superior in every way, but we'll permit you to voice your opinion in front of us. That's called tolerance. And you know what he taught. He said, I will bow down before the images of the Hindu faith. I will sit in meditation with the Buddhist in his vihara. I will kneel before the cross with the Christian. I will honor the fire of the Zoroastrian, and so on and so forth. In with each faith he identified himself. We've got them around the wall. And with each of them he identified himself that I'm this. There's nothing that I am not. Because we always go from truth to truth, from lower truth to higher truth, never from untruth to truth. There is no great religion in which there is not truth. Some way, some form of truth. Toleration and tolerance are not enough. There has to be real sympathy, real reverence, real acknowledgement of the values. And he knew, oh, how many times in India he taught, but that comes later, but I'm bringing it up now because to show what a respect he had for Islam, for the Indian form of it at any rate, the Indian form of Islam, he had great respect for it. And he gave this message at the Parliament of Religions, that all religions have truth in them. All religions are worthy of reverence, respect. And we should endeavor to relate to them so far as we can, and study and understand them. Absorb their message. Take what from it what we can get to benefit us. He said, I didn't come to the West to make the Christian a Hindu or the Buddhist a Vedantist. I came to make, to help make the Buddhist a better Buddhist, the Methodist a better, he mentions the Methodists by name, by the way, the Methodist a better Methodist, Quaker a better Quaker, God would say, and so on. All of these, he came to inject a deeper element of spirituality into the teachings, if possible, into the teachings and practice of people who were already practicing their religions. He mentioned the fact that in this connection he had occasionally spoken harshly about religions, and you can find passages in the works, because we have not censored the complete works. We have not tried to take out something that might not be politically correct. So if you go to the complete works of Swami Vivekananda, you will find that everything that he said is there. And he did on occasion ridicule, for instance, the Jains. He ridiculed the Jain monks for their lack of hygiene, for their unhygienic habits. And then he said in another lecture later, at the nearer the end of his life, I have been unfaithful to my teacher's way. My teacher's way of religion, I have not followed because I have spoken words of criticism. He never spoke a word of criticism of any sect. When Swamiji went to Sri Ramakrishna in the early days, he had prejudices which he had picked up not only from his Brahmin, not Brahmin, but his very highly educated family, and from his westernized family, and also from the Brahmo Samaj where he frequented. He had picked up prejudices against certain aspects of Hinduism, certain sects of ancient Hindu practice, critical of, sneered at, scoffed at. Sri Ramakrishna wouldn't put up with it. He said to him, well, who knows? Every great house has a scavenger's entrance. How do you know that there isn't also a scavenger's entrance to the life of the spirit? And he told him, don't do that. Don't criticize the Kartavaja and the other sects that were practicing Tantra and so on. So he never permitted that. But Swamiji confessed he hadn't been up to that mark himself. Another of the aspects of Swamiji's message, which I don't think he emphasized nearly enough, and that is our foolish pride in our knowledge of antiquity. Of course, you can't fault the scholars and prelates of that time too much, because they were not aware of Indian history in a way that people are now. If you go to seminary now, or you go to college now, university, you find that the professors of comparative religion, of the classics of antiquity, of the philosophy of the world, are aware, if not actually knowledgeable, about the antiquity of India. How many centuries before Christ? sciences and arts and literature and religion and philosophy and plain ordinary practical crafts were in vogue, were being utilized. A civilization was lying there undiscovered, uncovered. And Swamiji, in some of his preliminary talks before the Parliament of Religions, went up to New England, you know, and up in that area he talked about the gold standard. Look at that, there was a time of that big hassle over the gold standard. And the famous orators were preaching at that time. And he talked about Indian crafts and Indian art and music and literature. These things he talked about before he even came to the Parliament of Religions. And without any harsh words, he more or less politely pointed out to these New England pundits how slim, how scanty their knowledge was of the ancient world, and how wrongfully proud they were of the Greeks and starting everything with the Greeks, philosophy and science and politics and so on, all starting with Greece, as if there had never been an Orient. This pride in antiquity, in our knowledge of supposed antiquity of our culture from the Greek, was something which he had to attack, and he didn't do it in a very strong way, because some of the things he didn't know himself, didn't know how much was there in that treasure house uncovered. And then he said to the West, religion is a science. Now, 2 weeks ago, there came here a group of 20 candidates for the ministry from Columbia Theological Seminary, brought by Barbara Brown Taylor. And Barbara Taylor teaches at Piedmont College and also at Columbia Theological Seminary. So from Columbia Seminary, she brought to this room 20 imposing-looking candidates for the ministry. 10 men, 10 women. We had an hour and a half together. And I'm telling you, that was a very interesting affair. And I don't want to be gender prejudiced, but the women were much more responsive than the men. One of the men did ask. The last question that was asked in that hour and a half session was, what would you say is the most misunderstood aspect of Hinduism in the West? And my friend and student Vicky was sitting back here and listening. She piped up. She said, I think it's image worship. That's what the Muslims least understand, image worship. I said, that's true. I know that's true, but I don't think that for the answer to this question, I want to give that answer. I want to give the answer, the misunderstanding that yoga is something other than a science. Mm-hmm. Yoga is a science, a biological, human, physiological science. That is what Swamiji tried to tell in the West in the Raja Yoga book and other lectures. He tried to say, yoga is a science. Religion is a science. You don't treat it that way. In the West, you're not treating it as a science. You think that science is way off in this direction and religion is way off in that direction. You don't try to bring them together. Of course, Barbara was very happy about this because she's one of the people who writes on this, on that subject, science and religion. So in Swamiji's day, he came over. He had a what you call an ordinary college level understanding or education in science. In fact, he had a pretty good knowledge of science, and you know what concentration he had and how he would read. He could read, so memorize. So he knew science, and when he came over here, he said to himself, "This is a scientific people. These people are scientifically oriented and minded, and that plays the largest part in their culture. They're not going to be willing to listen to old superstitions and old wives' tales. They will want to know what India has to offer, world of science." And he brought what he knew of that and what he had practiced in that and presented it in Raja Yoga. And I believe that Raja Yoga is one of the most frequently read of Swamiji's books, most widely read and most frequently read of Swamiji's books. It's the first one I read. I was fascinated by this scientific approach to religion. And so I told this man, this would-be minister, and I thought failure to appreciate the scientific nature of yoga in Vedanta is the most missed opportunity so far as Hinduism is concerned. Another thing that Swamiji brought to the West very strongly was the life of Buddha. He felt that, and of course in those days the Buddhists were just as small, almost as small a minority as Hindus, if not more so, in the West. The Rhys Davids and other writers, the theosophists and some others, had brought a smattering of Buddhism to the West. A little bit of acquaintance was here. Buddha's life was known to people like Edwin Arnold, Sir Edwin Arnold, in India, in England. England was better acquainted with Buddhism than America, but Swamiji's idea was to present the life of one who was a perfect karma yogi. You know, after he attained nirvana, we all talk about what Buddha did to attain nirvana, and he was 45 years old when he attained nirvana, and 40 more years he spent serving India, Nepal and India. 40 more years. His life was a life of service, a life of solemnizing, judging, making judgments, making peace between peoples, tribes, going everywhere, starting up animal hospitals, refuges. So he wanted to present Buddha as the ideal karma yogi, and he did that, and he pointed out that Buddha never claimed anything for it. In other words, he was, in a sense, positioning Buddha against Jesus. I don't mean that he thought of it that way, but in a way you can see that he wanted to show the Christians, and he showed me in my life, that Buddha never claimed divinity for himself, never posted himself up as anything specially born from above. He said, "I am an awakened human being. I'm a man. I was awakened. And you can be awakened. Follow your own light and awaken yourself to this same wonderful state of enlightenment." So his message about Buddha was not only to present a great Indian and a great Hindu, but also to show that, oh, another thing he said was, you don't have to be crucified to be a hero. You don't have to be killed to be great, would ultimately died of poison, but that was his own choice. Of course, you say Christ was his own choice too. But the emphasis on violence, the emphasis on violence in Christianity, the emphasis on martyrdom and crucifixion and all that was not comfortable for Swamiji. And he tried to explain through the life of Buddha what the Hindus consider to be the acme of human spiritual development. And another element that came right out of his own heart, of course, was the idea of God as mother. He was more familiar with Protestants than with Catholics. I think he attended some Catholic service. I know he did. He attended Mass, and he attended some services in Catholic churches. He visited Catholic cathedrals and shrines in Europe. But he was primarily a Protestant. I mean, he saw primarily Protestants. He was educated as Protestant. And the idea of God as mother, he didn't find in the Protestant religions. And in fact, in Catholic Christianity, Mary is not quite God, as you know. Mary is the mother of God, but she is not considered to be an incarnation of God, she doesn't lead us to the figure of God the mother. And so many of the teachings of Swamiji in the West were connected with the idea of the Devi, either as Durga, or as Kali, or as one of the other forms, Jagadhatri and so on, of the Divine Mother in Hinduism. This concept of giving up fear. Why should we fear? This comes right out of his own teacher's experience. Sri Ramakrishna imbued all of his disciples, especially the monastic ones, with the idea that awe and fear of God are just the beginning of religion. One should quickly move on to an attitude of trust, faith, conviction, closeness, intimacy, love and warmth. God is, above all, the most lovable being that we know. What a pity that we keep him at arm's length through fear, awe, making him a judge. Those ideas he put forth, which were very definitely Vedantic or Hindu ideas, and I think he shocked a good many people with his remarks about God. But a new idea of God is one of the things he most had to put over in the West, and one of the ways he did that was to appeal to this figure of the motherhood of God. And Sri Ramakrishna, whenever he did talk, he didn't talk about him very much, about Ramakrishna, but he talked, when he did talk about him, he would talk about how to him God was mother, as to Jesus, God was Father, and drew that comparison. In many ways, he called himself the servant of the Divine Mother. He talked about his own work as being simply carrying out her will, her work in the world. And of course, parallel to that, along with that, connected to that idea of the beauty of God, the sweetness of God, the motherhood, the welcoming of the divine to our soul, was his decrying of the idea of sin. How many times you've heard him say in the West, think constantly of sin and you become a sinner. It is a sin to call man a sinner. It denies and berates his divine origin. Man has his origin in the divine, his soul, his core is divine. We are children of Brahman, we are children of God, we are children of the Mother. And the idea of sin is not worthy of us. He said this many times. Sri Ramakrishna had taught him in the same vein. Of course, the word sin occurs in the Hindu religion, but it's not emphasized. There isn't that guilt complex that we have in the West. There isn't that feeling that God is somewhere outside on a throne, up in the heavens, sitting as a judge, and with a great book of records, your sins and mine, waiting there to be judged. That's not the picture of God that the Hindu has, even if he does speak of sin. And Swamiji defined it. He said, good is anything which takes you closer to God and to others. Closer to God and to others. And evil is anything which sets you farther away from God and from others. That's the broadest possible definition you can have, and he gave that one. And he was complaining too about, in the West, about the word soul. You have not understood the word soul. From Plato on down, the psyche has been confused with the soul. Mind, he said, is not soul. When we talk about soul, we mean the Atman. It has no connection, it has no identification with mind. Almost all the philosophers of the West, until you get up to Schelling and some of the German, more recent German philosophers, the idealists, the man who wrote The Absolute, and I've forgotten the name. But most of the philosophers in the West have been fuzzy about identifying the mind and the soul. And Swamiji was very clear about it. He said, we do not call that the soul, which is subject to vicissitudes, always in flux, and which has a temporal life, and so on. We talk about the soul as coming from eternity, dwelling in eternity, and lasting to eternity. That is the soul. So, defining the soul was one of the most important things that he had to do for us. And then, of course, I hesitate to touch on this because in a couple of weeks you're going to hear all about it. But service as sadhana. The idea of the true meaning of philanthropy. You stand on a pedestal. You feel that you are the giver. You feel you have all the treasures in the world. And here is benighted so-and-so, somebody down here. And you're going to share, or you're going to give from your largesse you are going to donate to this person or that person in misery. From your large store you will help and raise, help him, raise him. That seemed to be the note, the keynote of the Parliament of Religions. Most of the people who, most of the ministers and clergymen of all stripes who were on that platform for those 20 days or whatever it was, 18 days, whatever it was, they were talking about the beauties of Christianity in terms of its ability to make the poor, to raise the condition of the poor and the benighted and the uneducated and the, those in misery, the homeless, and so on and so forth. It was a kind of show, a kind of bragging about how great the Christian religion had been in its efforts to carry out the message of the gospel, the social message of the gospel. And Swamiji injected into that scene this very different idea that there is no human being, what to speak of human being, there is no living being, animal or otherwise, who is not possessed of a soul, or rather who is not at basis the Atman, the spirit. We are all embodiments of spirit. He had to say this again and again. You are all gods. Every one of us is an unawakened form of divinity, unawakened or awakened. And you cannot paint the butterfly. You cannot gild the lily. You can only worship. You can only bow down and worship before one who, however he may appear, has the germ of possibility within him, a divine possibility. He once said, I have never yet seen the person who is not at least my equal. And he saw lots of people. So this idea of service and philanthropy and so on as being rooted in divine worship and nothing less, and being a means of spiritual practice for ourselves. I am benefited. I am helped. I am improved when I can carry coals to the man who needs fire, food to the man who is hungry, transportation to the person who is lost in the wilderness, and so on. The true meaning of philanthropy was one of the most radical, one of the most, I suppose, startling ideas that Swamiji brought to the West. Someday, one time a woman said to him, well, something about, how long are you going to be staying in America teaching religion? And, you know, he was brought up sharp by that, and he said to her, Madam, I am not teaching religion. I am selling my brain so that I can get some money to help my people. I am not teaching religion. I am selling my brain to get a little money to help my poor people in India. He came here not as a missionary. Don't make that mistake. Don't think that Swamiji came to the West as a missionary of Vedanta. That idea, of being something like that grew after he got here. He found that people were hungry for that. But he came to try to portray to the rich West the poverty of India and the need, and to extract, if possible, from the goodwill of the Western religious some kind of income, some kind of fund with which to start his work of the order in India. That's what he came for. And he was very disappointed because it didn't come, not much of it came. And then he had to really get to work. He found out what his mission was, and he had to stay and apparently teach religion. All of this, was just a little rundown. I just picked out some high points, you know, from the great long 4.5 years, I think, he spent over here with all sorts of messages for us. And out of that, I have picked some highlights. So that's just about what the size of it was. And yet, his name is hardly known in this country, even now. After all these years, more than a century, his name is hardly known in religious or spiritual circles. You say, well, that's your fault. You haven't broadcast it. You haven't advertised him. Well, I don't think it's the business of Westerners to advertise him. What I want to know is, why have not you, the Indians, why have you not banded together to bring his name to the fore in the West? You who have been immigrated to this country, to other countries in the West, England, fine. Instead of bringing over your traditional temples and your priests and all of the trappings of traditional Hinduism, why do you not band together and recognize the value of the message of Swamiji? The message of Swamiji to the West, and how important it is in the relationship between India and Swami, India and America and the West. Well, I have to turn now to the Swamiji's message to the East. What is Swamiji's message to the East? Well, it's a very long list, but I'm going to just take the next part of my hour to go down the line here on my short list. First of all, strength. Using the illustration of the gunas, he said, now remember I'm talking, now we're talking to Indians now. Indians in India. Tamas. Come out of this tamas. This ineptitude, this laziness, this low feeling, low esteem of oneself. Come out of that and be strong. Show some strength. Not only mentally, not only socially, but physically. Come out of it physically. Build up your bodies. Try to get better food. Try to eat better. Try to strengthen through exercise yourselves. That's what he told the young men in Calcutta. And besides that, he said, you don't know your own history. You do not know what is the history of your own country. You have not explored into the past. You do not know what you have been, and therefore you do not know your destiny. If you could know what you have been, if you could see, understand what the past has brought to you in the way of riches, values, heroes, volumes of inexplicably intricate books that are back there in the history of your land. Do you not know that you are? I have been around the world. He said, I've been around the world. I have been in many countries. China, Japan, Singapore, Hong Kong. And I have been in Canada, in America, England, Europe, Greece, and then Turkey. And I have been to all these places, and I tell you, the Hindus are the most moral people in the world. You are the most moral people in the world, and yet you have such low self-image. You pine away and regret and feel impoverished and feel helpless. You don't need to do that. You don't need to do that. He said the old ideas which have been kept secret in the caves and the forests and in the monasteries in India for so many centuries will have to be brought out and made broadcast in the world. You will have to bring these ideas to the hut of the fisherman, to the forges of the blacksmith. You'll have to bring them to the popular public markets. You have to bring them to the marketplace. Let everyone know, everyone who works in any field of endeavor in our public life must learn what are the ultimate secrets that the rishis discovered so long ago in the Vedas. Bring these secrets. Bring these rishis' discoveries from the Vedas and the Upanishads down into the public knowledge, because nobody knew them at that time. Don't bring your superstitions, he said. Don't bring along your superstitions. Don't make the kitchen and the cooking pot the altar, the place of worship, where you figure out how many different kinds of people have looked on your food and made it impure. All that stuff, leave. Let go. Let it go. He knew that there was a great movement at that time on for political independence. You realize that Swamiji came before Gandhiji, quite a while before Gandhiji. But you know there was the independence movement going on in India at that time. There were the forerunners of Gandhi, people of, what was it called, the national, what was it called? The movement
Swaraj.
Swaraj movement, yes. And he heard all that, and he met some of those people around Delhi and so on, who were trying to get into the inside of the British government and influence it for Indian interests and so on. And there was a lot of political talk even before Sri Aurobindo came along and before Nivedita and all the hotheads came along with their even their violence for independence. And he said, political independence is something which has to be deserved. You cannot make yourselves independent without being people who deserve to be independent, who feel independent in their hearts. You have lost that feeling of independence and of Swaraj, of self-rule. You have lost the self-rule of your own lives. And because you have lost the self-rule of your own lives, you have lost the self-rule of the country. So you are going to have to be deserving of self-rule before that English government is going to even think of letting you become independent. And you know, it was his appearance in London, it was his work in the West, in London, it was the acquainting of himself with the highfalutin Londoners. Not the Hoepler, the highfalutin Londoners. He had lunch with the princes, Victoria's sons, the Queen Victoria's sons. He had lunch with them. He had interviews with them. He made a splash in England. And because of that splash that he made, the beginnings of respect for the Indian people and the Indian mystique was found. The seeds were sown. Seeds were sown. He was not a Gandhian. I don't think he would have taken to the methods of Gandhi, but he certainly was a believer in the independence of India eventually. But he wanted them to be up to the mark, to be able to take it on. And he knew that they were not at that time. Then he asked them to turn and look at the West. He asked the Indians to turn and look at the West. Understand how in the West a spirit of cooperation develops among people who feel equal because of the caste system and other feelings of inequality. It was very difficult at that time for Indian people, businessmen, to get cooperative and to be respecting one another, and for a democratic spirit to arise. He said the things that you need to pick up from the West are the democratic spirit, the spirit of business cooperation, learning how to form a joint stock company and things like that. He said you have to see how their society has grown and developed through being secular. I think he would have, he definitely was a sponsor of the Nehru ideas of secular government. He was certainly at the back of, his thinking was at the back of Nehru's approach to the secularism of the Indian freedom movement, and wanting it to be not taking a religious bias, respecting and welcoming all forms of religion. And there were, in that time, there were Sikhs and there were Parsis and there were Muslims, and he had to support, Nehru had to support all those things, and he got that from Swamiji's ideas too. He told the Indians, a new power has come, and a new company of workers. With the building of the Ramakrishna Mott and Mission, with the advent of Sri Ramakrishna to this time of ours, a new power, a spiritual power, had come to the world, and it was going to be influenced. It was going to be influential. It was going to be the seed and core of the development of a new system, a new company of philanthropic servants of the land. The what's that military expression that he used? Oh, I can't think of it. Something's in joiners. There's a couple of words that come out of the military milieu that he used to use. Sappers and miners. The sappers and miners. Whatever that means. But it's a military term. Do you know what it means? The sappers and miners was a term that was used in those days for engineers, military engineers, I think it was. So he said, we are going to be the sappers and miners of the new society, the new Indian society, which will arise from this band of workers made by Sri Ramakrishna. And he deplored the hold that Shankaran thinking had over the country. Too much Shankaran monasticism, too much emphasis on renunciation of the world and going off into the hills and the mountains and the deserts and becoming hermits, and thinking of the world as an illusion, and all of that that I call misunderstood Shankara. It's misunderstood because that's not what Shankara said. But his followers put it into that mold, and a great number of centuries has rolled by in which Shankara's influence has permeated the society and made it otherworldly, so to speak. And he deplored that. And finally, he said that Hinduism has to be self-conscious. See, this is, I find this to be true wherever I go in this country, in the schools and the colleges, and the interfaith meetings that I go to. They are always asking me, what does Hinduism say? Because they don't know Vedanta, they don't know the term Vedanta. And they don't know that I prefer to be called a Vedantist. They call me a Hindu. So they say, what does a Hindu say about this, about that, about this policy, about that question, this issue, that issue? And you know, the beauty of it and the tragedy of it is you can't say what Hinduism says. Hinduism is not an organized religion with policies and platforms and politically correct statements and popes and churches and organized seminaries. That's not the religion of the Hindus. They don't trust that kind of religion. They don't want that kind of religion. And so, to answer questions like that is very difficult. So it's a fine line that Swami Vivekananda gives us, a very fine line between Hindu self-consciousness and what is now called Hindutva, the criticizing of other religions and the exalting of the Hindu religion above others is something modern. They have learned it from the sectarians of other religions, people who missionarize and criticize India and so on. From that, they have got their backup and they have learned to respond and react to that kind of talk, and so they begin to criticize the Muslims and the Christians and the Westerners, and even amongst themselves, people who are liberal, they criticize. This is the unfortunate side of the Renaissance of Hinduism. Swami Vivekananda would not have wanted that, not in any way, because he never disrespected or criticized other religions if he could help it. And on the other hand, at the same time, he told the East, you must have some kind of cohesion, you must have a message on which to stand, you must have a witness before the world, you must have a policy in relation to the rest of the universe. You must be seen, you must be visible, you must know.